Welcome back. Hope that was a supportive period of movement, of practice, however that looked to you this morning. And so we'll begin our sitting practice now. And I really want to invite you just to, as we're settling, call in this knowledge that you're not practicing on alone. Call in this knowledge that you're here in community. So just closing your eyes if that feels supportive. And again, if not, you can have a soft gaze, not really focusing on anything in particular. And just envisioning yourself here among Sangha. The women in this group. Any other communities or Dharma friends? Just calling them all in to be here with you. You might envision them standing or sitting with you in a circle, and maybe you even see some of their faces smiling back out at you. Just allowing yourself to rest here in that knowing that even if you're alone in the room or in your home, you're not practicing alone. You are held in this web of connection. You might even call in to this circle your teachers, benefactors, supporters. You might call in the Buddha or Kuan Yin. You might call in the earth herself to sit with you. Allowing the felt sense of this circle that you're calling in to grow stronger. Allowing it to become almost visceral. Allowing that power of your imagination to support that. Noticing what that feels like in the body, the mind, the heart. To be in this community in your mind's eye. And as you continue through this period of practice, knowing that you can always return just to this sense, knowing that you're surrounded by Sangha, that you're held, inviting whoever you need to be with you into this circle. And as you rest here, just beginning to notice your breath. Noticing where your breath goes as you breathe in. And noticing where your breath goes as you breathe out. Just inviting your attention to land gently with kindness here in the breath. And finding where, just on that intuitive level, it feels supportive, pleasant, interesting. To focus on the breath. It could be the sensation of air at the nostrils, the rise and fall of the chest, movement of the entire body breathing. Just allowing yourself to stay with the breath in the body. Letting it become the primary object of your attention. If at any point you feel distracted or the mind is pulling you in one direction or another, just knowing that's okay, it's natural. And just returning gently to the body breathing. And even in those minutes of returning, you might again conjure up that image of our circle. Knowing that you're in good company and returning to the breath. Returning to the present moment. Knowing that in every moment of practice, every moment of returning, you're practicing with thousands of years of practitioners, Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, kind, caring people. That all of that stands behind you, all of that has your back. to continue to practice. You might even want to turn towards that felt sense. How is this moment? How am I relating to this moment? Maybe it feels pleasant or relaxing, and you want it to continue or just sink into it. Or maybe it's not so comfortable. Maybe you find yourself waiting for something to stop happening, or waiting for something to start happening. Maybe you're waiting for the end of practice or the moment when you finally feel relaxed. Just noticing, however it is, what that's like. When we get quiet and settle into the breath, oftentimes an entire symphony of experience pops up all around it. And it's okay to notice that, to tend to that. And then to return just gently and kindly back to the breath. Feeling the aliveness of the body breathing. Remembering that there are billions of other breathing beings here on this earth that all want the same happiness that you want. Mindfulness of breathing can be a concentration exercise. It can be a way that we gain insight. And it can also be a reminder of how deeply connected we are. Remembering how all of the trees and plants from miles around us are a part of the air we breathe. Remembering that we're connected to all the breathing animals and people, but we're also connected to all the plants, everything on this earth. Remembering that each breath we take is a testament to that. And in this final minute of practice, just really allowing yourself to gently begin to come back into the room. You might invite a little bit of movement into the body, maybe moving the shoulders or the neck. You might want to take a little bit of a look around the room, and just slowly reorienting back to seeing, moving the eyes and the head, maybe letting the eyes land on something that's kind of pleasant to look at. And then returning to our circle. Thank you for your practice. I want to share a poem by Lucille Clifton. It's just resonating with me this week. She writes, "May the tide that's entering even now, the lip of our understanding, carry you out beyond the face of fear. May you kiss the wind and turn from it, certain that it will love your back. May you open your eyes to water, water waving forever. And may you, in your innocence, sail through this to that." May we all, in our innocence, sail through this to that. Each one of you is on a path. In our own ways, we are all moving somehow, somewhere, from this to that. And in our practice, that means facing our fears, our uncertainties, our grief, whatever it may be, to sail through this life with awakening right there as our North Star, with freedom as our North Star. And sometimes on this voyage, we encounter great storms, big changes. We encounter things we don't always know how to navigate. And it seems like these days, there's a lot of that. Like many of you, I have been feeling really deeply impacted by the shootings recently, by the murder of Tyree Nichols. I've also been sitting with a lot of people who are going through major changes. They're going through job transitions. So many people who've lost jobs lately. People who are going through major health challenges, relationship changes. And with each one of these, you know, it brings up a question for me. As Buddhist practitioners, what is our relationship towards grief, towards change, towards loss? You know, how do we navigate and work with this particular flavor of dukkha, of suffering? Each one of us probably has experienced some kind of change or some kind of loss. With every change, even the good ones, there's a loss. You know, we have a new baby and we grieve who we were before that moment, even in those joys of welcoming a new little one into the world. We grieve the autonomy or the better nights of sleep. We grieve our identity. And grief is something that the dominant culture tends to view as a type of suffering that should be brief, maybe a few weeks or a few months, and then just resolved, right? And yet at the same time, we also live in a culture where we're more isolated from community, where we're not necessarily encouraged to feel change or grief deeply, where we don't necessarily have the kind of traditions, the witnessing, the support. And in a lot of ways, it feels kind of like we live in a culture that says, get over any grief or loss or change fast, but don't actually do the feeling or the collective mourning or the changes that are necessary to process. With every change, there's a witnessing, there's a falling apart, there's a coming back together, sometimes over and over and over. That's required to really move into whatever phase is next. Anyone who's grieved doesn't know that or knows that our culture doesn't always handle it so well. And there's actually even a term for that. When our grief is at odds with some element of the dominant culture, they call it disenfranchised grief. It's when our grief doesn't fit neatly in a box about society's idea of how we should be grieving or handling things or what we should be grieving. And we see this a lot, Someone loses a pet and people say, "Oh, you're not over that yet? Aren't you going to get a new dog soon?" And people aren't always ready for that. That's the kind of loss that's deep, actually. For so many people, that's the loss of a family member. And that's one example, but there's many. Our grief over the climate crisis, or our grief over the changes that have happened over these years due to COVID, there's not always a place for it in our society. But it's part of the human experience to feel loss. It's of our nature that we don't want to be separated from the things that we love, whether it's a person or a job or a community or a way of life or something else. And there's so many different facets to this. Each type of change, each type of loss, each type of grief we experience in a lifetime has a really unique impact on our sense of self, of our way of relating to the world, our sense of belonging and connection. Grief changes us. So, how do we approach loss, change, grief? They all kind of go together, really, from a Dharma lens. Grief can be a teacher, and it has many, many lessons to share. And this can be a refuge when we're in the midst of a time that feels really turbulent. And so we ask, how do we let grief transform us? How do we actually allow our suffering to alchemize our hearts, ignite our compassion? One of the most poignant Buddhist stories relating to this is the story of Kisa Gotami. I feel like it's one of the most raw and beautiful and real Dharma stories out there. Gotami was her family name, And she actually, as a young person, was in fairly poor health. And so she was called Kisa Gotami, which actually translates to frail Gotami. And she was born into a fairly poor household. And when Kisa Gotami grew up, she married and she went to the house of her husband's family to live, as was the tradition. But because she was the daughter of a poor household, they treated her with a lot of contempt and a lot of disrespect. And after a time, she gave birth to a son. And with that, the family started to treat her with respect. They started to value her more, be kinder to her. And, she loved her son tremendously, not just because of this change in her family situation. Of course, there was a deep bond, her first child. But only a couple of years after her son's birth, he became sick and died. And she was just heartbroken, totally devastated. Kisa Gotami could not let her child go. And she carried him, and she carried his body with her into the village, asking everyone she encountered if they knew of medicine that could bring him back to life. And no one knew what to say until one day a compassionate and wise person saw her and understood that she was actually so overcome with heartbreak and sorrow that she'd been nearly driven mad. Which happens, right? And they told her that the Buddha was who she should see, and that the Buddha might have some kind of medicine that could help her situation. And so she traveled to the Buddha, and he said that he could offer some type of help, but that in order to do so, she had to obtain a handful of mustard seeds from a household that had not ever experienced death. And so Ami went from house to house to house, all across her village and beyond. And she explained what was happening, why she was there, asking every household if they had not experienced death. And of course, each home had faced death at this time. Many generations of family had actually been born and then passed away within that very home. These people could not give her a mustard seed. There was nothing that they could do except share their stories and allow Kisa Gotami to share hers. And house after house, she went, sharing with other families, hearing about their own grief, hearing about their love, and sharing about her own. Eventually, Kisa Gotami had been to every house in the village, and many houses even beyond her village. But she was still without mustard seeds. And so she returned to the Buddha. And in her journey, she began to understand why he'd sent her on that pilgrimage. She saw both the truth of impermanence, that actually everyone had experienced some type of loss, but also the fact that she wasn't alone in this. Not a single person that she encountered had not grieved, had not experienced loss, had not touched in some way the deep impermanence of our lives. And they were all connected in this way. Part of the Buddha's wisdom here really is that understanding that grief isn't best held alone, that we actually need to be witnessed and cared for, that we need to be able to witness and care for others. And this is really, you know, part of the beauty of the Buddha's teachings is that every single person who came asking for his guidance and his help, the medicine that he offered would usually just be subtly or quite different for each individual person. It wasn't one size fits all. There was something in Kisa Gotami's experience that the Buddha understood needed to be held in community. She needed to be able to feel held. She needed to be able to connect to love, connect to support, connect to the interconnectedness that she could feel. Because so much of the time when we're experiencing suffering, we feel so alone. Part of the nature of suffering in many ways is that we feel a loss of connection. And that can happen with grief and loss. It can happen with physical pain. It can happen with illness. It can happen when we move to a new town or get a new job. In most suffering, there's like a subtle flavor of aloneness, of isolation. And so often the medicine is connection. And there are so many ways that this experience of grief, of loss, of being separated from things that we love can teach us. In an essay on grief and Buddhism, Roshi Joan Halifax writes, "Maybe we can let loss work us. To deny grief is to rob ourselves of the heavy stones that will eventually be the ballast for the two great accumulations of wisdom and compassion. To deny grief is to rob ourselves of the heavy stones that will eventually be the ballast for the two great accumulations of wisdom and compassion." This sharpens our connection to wisdom and compassion. When the heart is tender, we begin to feel into the need for that wisdom and compassion more and more and more. You know, wisdom, depending on the situation, might say, "This is unacceptable," or "This needs to change." Wisdom might say also, "This is nature. This is just part of what it is to be human. I'm not alone in experiencing the suffering." Wisdom might say every single one of those in the same breath, because all of them can be true. The compassion actually takes the wisdom, that insight, that understanding, and it asks, "How can I help?" Compassion in the face of loss can spark generosity. It can spark mutual aid, movement building. It can spark kindness. Probably each one of us has experienced some kind of hardship. And when we encounter someone else who's going through the same thing out in the world, there's an upwelling of tenderness and also an upwelling of this desire to see it be different for that person. This desire for them not to suffer quite so much as maybe we did. Countless organizations, countless people being of service There's so much that's been built from that heartfelt desire of, I know how painful this is. I don't want you to have to do it alone. And together, wisdom and compassion can offer us balance and a path forward so that we can be with grief and loss in a really skillful way. Right? Wisdom actually gives us the equanimity, the presence, the understanding that suffering happens, that we live in a time of great suffering where there are many unjust systems, where there are many situations that are incredibly difficult. And wisdom understands that some of this suffering is natural. It understands the Four Noble Truths, that there is suffering. But wisdom also understands that there is a path out of suffering. And compassion imbues us with the care, with the love, with that energy, that passion, really, to help find our way out of suffering and to help others find their way out of suffering. When we're able to have wisdom and compassion, it becomes easier to feel our grief, to actually let loss be known in the body and the heart, and to really fully allow this human experience. Allowing that is part of how we encounter the truth. And in so many ways, it's actually a kind of a virtuous cycle. That when we actually allow ourselves to feel our own pain and to know it and understand it, we deepen in our wisdom and we deepen in our compassion. And that wisdom and compassion allows us to be with whatever it is we're experiencing with greater presence. This is part of how we encounter the truth. Philip Elliott Slater writes, "Despair is the only cure for illusion. Without despair, we cannot transfer our allegiance to reality. It's a kind of mourning period for our fantasies. Some people don't survive this despair, but no major change within a person can occur without it. Grief can alchemize us. It can actually cut through our delusion or our silence or our hesitancy so that we can move forward with compassion and wisdom. And from that place, we can create change for ourselves, but also for our communities. In the end, I think in a lot of ways, Kisa Gotami, in her experience grieving and connecting with community, I think she might also have a lot to say about love. Because grief is the other side of love. We don't grieve when there's not deep, deep care. And grief can alchemize us to understand the very power of that love. You know, the grief we feel when a child in our lives experiences, you know, that kind of disillusionment that comes as they get older. Or the grief we feel when our body changes due to illness. The grief we feel around all kinds of loss. It really reveals to us the depth of our care. There is something when we really allow ourselves to sense into grief into loss. That just sort of lands us deep, deep into that heart of love when we can be with it. And so part of what we're practicing here is navigating this life. You know, like Lucille Clifton shared, sailing in our innocence, in our goodness from this to that. We're trying to get through, to have meaning, to do good. And in some ways we have to allow the heart to be broken. But in that broken heart, we also begin to feel how incredibly strong and how incredibly resilient that heart is. The broken heart knits itself back together in ways that are awe-inspiring. This is part of our task, to understand suffering, to understand the causes of suffering, and also to seek that path outside of suffering towards liberation. And much of how we do this is through love. Tennessee Williams writes, "The world is violent and mercurial. It will have its way with you. We are saved only by love. Love for each other. And the love we pour into the art we feel compelled to share. Being a parent. Being a writer. Being a painter. Being a friend. We live in a perpetually burning building, and what we must save from it all the time is love." And this is our task. When we walk through this world, and this may be grief's greatest teaching, that power and importance of love in the face of impermanence. Through this, we learn the power of our love, the strength of our bonds and our interconnectedness, and truly the preciousness of every moment. Grief can connect us to the deepest and most profound compassion and crack open that heart of love. And from love can come compassion and action. Yeah, thank you for your kind attention.